Welcome to the Science and Policy Seminars podcast, brought to you by the Centre for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. The seminar series brings together different perspectives and new thinking on the relationship between scientific expertise, policy, and politics. To learn more about the Centre for Science and Policy and our work in promoting engagement between researchers and policy professionals, please visit csap.cam.ac.uk.
What I want to do here, my sort of particular ambition, is to consider what kind of statecraft is now necessary and what's viable as the UK appears set on the course of some sort of evolution towards a looser model of union or perhaps even towards a federal system. More specifically, I want to draw attention to the unduly neglected question of what kind of centre and what kind of governing ethos and strategic understanding are appropriate to such a transition, a focus, I will argue, that needs to become much more integral to debate in this area. So while much constitutional argument in the UK still relies upon broadly Whiggish notions of the cumulative wisdom enshrined in the centre and the ethos and values embodied in governing institutions, I want to invoke a very different point of reference to explore these issues. It's broadly the kind of analytical focus upon the state and the nature and limits of territorial rule, which has its roots in some of the leading traditions of Tory statecraft. And that's actually part of a broader project that I'm beginning to develop now and I've been thinking about at CSAP. And specifically here, I want to derive insights and some questions from the landmark study Territory and Power, written by British political scientist Jim Bulpit, which was published in 1984. And as some of you I know here will be aware, and some of you I know that book and his work far better than I do. It's a fairly new source for me. I mean, it was clearly a highly distinctive work in a number of respects, and whilst it disappeared from view in relative terms for a while, I know it's become of interest again to a number of scholars, and I know Helen in particular has, and others have written on Bulpit. Focus upon the centre and its role within the broader territorial system is pretty rare in the political analysis and commentary that have appeared in the context of the Scottish referendum due in September and in the voluminous analyses of devolution supplied by political scientists. Much of this literature takes as a given the assumption that the territorial politics of the UK are mainly determined by developments and trends in the peripheries, in the geographical peripheries. A handful, only a few exceptions aside, much of this literature overlooks or negates consideration of the importance of the interactions between periphery and centre, without which I would suggest an understanding of how the SNP has achieved its current political position would be impossible. Precious little of this literature takes up Bulpit's challenge to understand or to think about territorial politics as a system that is to a considerable degree shaped by the strategic preferences of and political dynamics affecting the centre. Bulpit was particularly critical of what I've called sort of peripheralist thinking and indeed of various other paradigms, including sort of broadly Whiggish approaches, and insisted upon the importance of the relationship between the centre and the peripheral territories across the kingdom, and notably, and I'll return to this later, included England within his conception of the periphery. He gave particular emphasis to the political dynamics shaping and inhibiting the centre's attempt to construct a territorial system which would enable it to pursue its core objectives. And I'm going to follow in his wake in terms of emphasising political factors in understanding some of the current debates about and dimensions of territorial politics in the UK. Over time, he argued, this approach by the state has resulted in the development of a system of territorial management that was mostly stable because it gave limited forms of autonomy to local elites in return for the legitimacy that they were supposed to bestow upon the centre. And considering the challenge facing and necessity for statecraft in the current situation, there are, I think, a number of insights to be gathered from Bulpit's argument. I'm going to abstain here from a fuller and more rounded engagement with his ideas, some of which don't, I think, work, and some of which I think are not so well-founded, but that's for another day. But here I'm going to sort of draw fairly loosely, actually, upon a number of different ideas within his work. He famously defined the centre in parsimonious terms as, quote, the locus of actual political power within the central governing complex. And that's a rather cryptic formulation, which he fleshed out a little through the analogy he drew with the pre-modern court. His characterization played upon a key analytical distinction between, on the one hand, statewide organization and capacity, which is where, that's what most contemporary political science and public policy analysis looks at, on the one hand, but what he's interested in is the inner sanctum, where a common understanding underpins a strategic outlook that's shared by a small group of actors at the apex of the political and policy communities. His conceptualization of the centre remains somewhat elusive in empirical terms. And I know there's a sort of long-standing debate about how you might define and measure the centre. And it may well be hard, I think, to operationalize in strict terms now, given the range of networks which have emerged within around central service departments and the more dispersed manner in which government operates. Excuse me. Yet the attention he drew to the nexus of decision-making and personal relations which constituted the domain of the centre, and also to the governing wisdom shared by the elite actors who operated within it, remain, I think, of considerable value. And it is striking, I think, that a number of accounts of the recent premierships, both of Blair and Brown, I'm thinking particularly of Anthony Seldon, the way in which he writes about those governments, very much focus upon the court and the court-like relationships that develop in those governments. So it's interesting to think of how that analogy, the idea of a court, still works, actually, in a broadly Bulpitian way. Bulpit also gave emphasis in his account to the tacit, rarely articulated nature of the governing code in the British tradition. He identified as a distinct and separate entity what he called the central value system associated with the centre, which represented a loose bundle of ideas and values that were to be publicly aired by leading institutions and elite supporters, and which faced off against peripheral value systems and their non-elite supporters. In the current context, there are clearly growing doubts about whether the unionist value system, which has been encoded within long-established ideas and forms of Britishness, can still provide the source of the legitimacy and tacit support which the centre requires. Bulpit Centre possesses an irreducible interest in retaining as much autonomy as possible from both domestic and external pressures, in order, he says, to concentrate upon its core objectives, which in the modern period he broadly characterises as the provision of security, the development of the economy, the management of budgets, and the modernisation of core services. In the UK, the centre came to favour structures for managing issues that arose within the periphery through the granting of limited forms of autonomy to sympathetic local elites. His argument was also notable for the significant stress he placed on what he called, quote, the political process of centre-local relations, a focus that ensured he gave far more weight to overtly political matters such as interests, parties, elite codes and conventions than did other prevalent ways of understanding the constitution, and frankly that still marks out his work compared to most literature on the constitution, and also on kind of comparative literatures, I think, that are relevant to the UK. So how might Bulpit's framework help us understand the question of statecraft in the context of the UK after devolution? That's my real focus here. It provides the basis, I will suggest, for a distinct and quite unconventional reading of the devolution model which Labour introduced and of subsequent developments in this area in comparison to those supplied by most academic and political debate. In Bulpit's terms, and I'll just try and sketch what I think that reading would look like. In Bulpit's terms, excuse me, the first Blair government, which obviously made the first major devolution moves in relation to Wales, Scotland, and of course in a different way in Northern Ireland. The first Blair government operated with a mixed governing code, which was in some important ways very contiguous with that of its Conservative predecessors. It was for the most part wary of creating forms of authority that might frustrate central intervention, even though, of course, it did so in a whole series of respects, and of course, feared creating destabilising dynamics for the UK, though it accepted that Northern Ireland was a special case where a power-sharing assembly was seen as the only way of neutralising sectarian conflict. And yet, at the same time, a significant pressure to introduce devolution referendums emerged primarily from the growing presence in its parliamentary party of pro-devolution Scottish and Welsh MPs, who had shifted in this direction in response to significant changes in their constituents' views under the previous Conservative governments. These were politicians operating near to the centre who had, in Bulpit's terms, come to operate and think like local representatives. And so devolution became the other half of New Labour's composite governing code. But its incorporation as a strategic objective did not produce any significant shift in the character of the government's thinking on territorial issues, or at least in the terms of the centre, as Bulpit defined it. Ministers tasked with justifying these reforms trotted out broadly Whiggish arguments about the incremental, adaptive nature of reforms that always seemed likely, to some observers, to be more fundamental and unpredictable in kind. Now, the sort of classic quotation of that sort, which I've sort of included in the book, was Derry Irvine's sort of rather throwaway remark about the English question when faced with the English question in the by debate in Parliament on devolution. He says, well, of course, the whole point about the English question is it's best not to ask it. That's the best answer we can currently give, which is fits very well, I think, within that sort of a certain kind of self-confident Whiggish discourse. Well, generally, Labour continued in its years of government to pursue a centre autonomy model, in Bulpit's terms, in its management of devolution. It strove to ensure that the devolved institutions did not become locations for local politicians to channel peripheral dissidents back to the centre. And it addressed this task in part, of course, by opting for electoral systems that would, it hoped, offset the risks of challenger nationalist parties becoming ascendant. It also sought to find what Bulpit termed local elite collaborators. I mean, there is that very blunt language in Bulpit, which does cut to the heart of some of these issues, which you don't find in current debate. But the point about these people were they would not undermine the state or the centre's promotional strategy. And that's interesting to think about if you recall Blair's rather clunky attempts, of course, to ensure that control over the selection of leaders in both the Welsh and Scottish Party, attempts that broadly mostly backfired. Bulpit was himself, of course, sceptical about the idea that the kinds of devolution proposals that became prominent in the 1970s, when he would have been thinking about devolution, he was sceptical about the idea that those could provide the basis for a stable territorial settlement. His particular concern, which you might think was well-founded, was that establishing alternative political centres offered a dangerous opportunity for political opponents of the current settlement to establish a foothold within the system. And, of course, they were enabled to politicise territorial issues in their dealings with unionist parties locally and also with the centre. What makes his analysis somewhat prescient was his sense, I think, of the acute tension between the attempts to employ a governing code, which was broadly contiguous with this idea of central autonomy on the one hand, and the increasing and inevitable strain which devolution placed upon the established centre-periphery relationship, which made that governing code viable in the first place. But for a few years, it looked like he'd been proved wrong. Devolution achieved a degree of stability and legitimacy at first, a situation that was primarily contingent, of course, upon Labour's large parliamentary majority, and of course the party being in power at both the UK and the Scottish and Welsh levels, as well as a relatively buoyant economy, always an important dimension of Bulpit's analysis. But devolution also let several tricky constitutional genies out of the bottle, and these were soon apparent. And I'm just going to chart the different impacts of devolution and then also load into the analysis some other factors that actually predated devolution but then began to interact with it in ways that politicised and undermined, I think, the system of territorial management that Labour tried to introduce. Perhaps the most underappreciated aspect, impact of devolution, was at the level of public discourse. Not only did these reforms destroy the lingering mythology of the UK as a unitary state, of course it wasn't a unitary state, but that was a kind of abiding mythology of the state nation as it was perceived, but it also crucially engineered a novel requirement for politicians to explain or to account for the system of territorial governance to the English, who now suddenly found themselves essentially the last remaining people governed directly from Whitehall. Obviously, other peoples in the UK were governed by Whitehall, but actually, clearly, it was obvious that there was a sort of more mixed set of governance arrangements. And that sense of kind of realisation dawning upon the English about their very different position in governance terms is, I think, a sort of crucial dynamic which devolution introduces. But as a greater sense of national self-awareness among the national majority of the UK, the English, had become more apparent in this period, which I argue in this book, the question of how this people relate to the systems of governance and politics which confront them has become much more fraught. Yet, in political terms, relatively little attention was paid to providing a public justification for devolution, and indeed the lack of any equivalent provision in England, with the notable exception, of course, of London. This may well have been a hangover of what Bulpett saw as the kind of unarticulated nature, the tacit nature of the governing code lodged at the heart of the British state, and also reflected Labour's determined refusal to concede that devolution required any kind of abridgment of the principles of the Westminster system. Other unforeseen consequences of devolution have also become increasingly salient. Labour envisaged these reforms in Bulpittian terms as a novel way of addressing the old problem of pacifying the far-flung regions while preserving the integrity and autonomy of the centre. It followed that these changes were conceived as adjustments to the margins, which required little compensatory alteration at the centre. True, they triggered the introduction of a thin set of conventions regarding intergovernmental coordination, and there were the signing of a number of bilateral accords between some Whitehall departments and their counterparts in the devolved authorities, which of course is a sort of classic kind of Whitehall sort of innovation, a sort of response. But in practice, those meant very, very little. And so, little attention was paid either to the potential need for institutional reforms at the centre, which might now be required to manage the changes associated with these new forms of territorial autonomy. One of the debates triggered by devolution was whether there needs to be the introduction of a central department which provides a focus for the different territories and perhaps the regions of England. And so central service departments were left to develop and manage relations with their equivalents in the devolved authorities on a largely ad hoc basis. Sometimes very successfully, it should be said, but I mean with an incredible degree of variation across different departments. This also resulted in some cases in very poor coordination, notably in those areas such as transport, the management of natural resources or environmental policy, where territorial boundaries represent artificial constraints upon the development of viable policy solutions. And the quality and scope of intergovernmental relationships continues to vary considerably across different departments. This situation was accentuated considerably following the election of the SNP in Scotland, when sections of the civil service in Edinburgh aligned themselves in good Westminster fashion with their political masters and developed a much more adversarial and sometimes combative approach to their relations in Whitehall. And that sort of culminated in the production of the infamous White Paper on Independence, which I gather has now triggered quite a sort of angst-ridden debate within Whitehall about the very possibility of having a kind of unified civil service across the different territorial regions. standard criticism of Labour's devolution reforms, which you've probably all heard at some point or other, is the refrain that Labour ought to have anticipated that what it saw as a brand new gleaming settlement would turn out to be a rather unpredictable, ratchet-like process, fueling ever greater ambitions among politicians in the periphery for more powers to be devolved from Whitehall and putting ever greater strain on an already asymmetrical system. And yet, it should be noted, most commentators, in fact nearly all commentators in this area, were supportive of devolution. And very, very few, having worked my way through this literature, I can report, very few foresaw the idea in any kind of concrete way that this was a process. For many experts, devolution represented a move that was eminently sensible in the context of the rise of nationalisms outside England and the prevailing sort of belief in the literature is that this can be made to work within the existing constitutional system. In fact, it's interesting to note some commentators who now do identify the idea that this was a process, not a finished settlement, were not saying that when devolution was itself introduced. But I would suggest that Labour's bigger error, deficiency, which is highlighted, I think, by Bulpit's framework, was to believe that by converting the differential governance arrangements that already existed in Scotland, Wales and London into various forms of elected government with various powers available to them, it would, they thought, be possible to turn the clock back and to return to the kind of dual system which Bulpit characterises as the source of relative stability in the early part of the 20th century. And the dual system he identifies as a system of where there's a kind of parallel development between central government and local government, a relatively little degree of interpenetration between them, almost kind of separate spheres. And I think something like that was in Labour's mind in a territorial sense when it developed devolution. Of course, the party was also a victim of its own political hubris in relation to the politics of the peripheries outside Northern Ireland, underestimating the capacity of nationalist parties to regroup and to prosper in the devolved authorities, and failing to appreciate that the electoral systems it introduced would accelerate the demise of two-party politics in these areas and provide important opportunities for new challenges to emerge outside Westminster. And of course, those challenges are not just within challenger parties. Think of Boris Johnson as well as Alex Salmond. It's also within the emergence of what Bulpit saw as essentially local politicians within the mainstream parties. Well, generally, devolution has proved to be a rather inadequate tool, or clunky tool, really, for peripheralising territorially related issues, and instead resulted in the politicisation across the UK of some of the distributional questions which were allocated as responsibilities to devolved authorities. Increasingly, the English began to cast envious, doubting eyes at the Scots' decision to sustain universalist approaches in health and social care, and of course student financing, without having to concern themselves about raising or managing their own revenues, given the nature of the block grant system through which Scotland was funded by Whitehall. Above all, Labour's model of devolution unwittingly infringed one of the foundational but unspoken rules which Bulpit observed about the relationship of the English people with the centre. And this, I think, of all his many very sort of striking and often quite cryptic sort of historical judgments, this, I think, is in some ways one of his most insightful as well as counterintuitive. This was his judgment, his observation, that in historical terms, the English were, for the most part, reluctant to take on the burdens of formal imperial control within the UK. And indeed, you know, it's an interesting argument about whether that was also true externally as well, but that's a separate argument. And on his account, it repeated key points when he looks at what he calls the kind of development of the internal empire. He notes how the English had to be cajoled and persuaded to overcome a deep-seated wariness about extending their control over the peninsula they dominated to in more extended, a wariness about formal and direct control. The basis of this reluctance, he says, was a worry about the fiscal consequences of such a strategy, based upon a fairly accurate appreciation of the distribution of natural resources of wealth within the wider kingdom. Of course, North Sea Oil has rather complicated that calculation. But also based upon a fear that once fully incorporated into the polity, the peoples of the far-flung territories would demand rights of representation at the centre. What's really striking, and I think almost spookily prescient about that judgment, is that those are the two main issue areas where a sense of nationally rooted grievance became most pronounced amongst the English since the devolution. Polling suggests that the question of the distribution of public expenditure across the territories of the UK has in the last few years become the issue of greatest concern in territorial terms for the English. That's, if we don't include, obviously, you might include Europe in territorial terms, but that's a sort of slightly different territorial focus. But within the domestic union, that's undoubtedly the number one issue of concern for the English. The question of how public spending is distributed is one that Bulpit would certainly have recognised as an age-old sore, not a novel challenge. It has a long history within the UK. But disaffection with current patterns of allocation, which strikingly stretches across Wales, Scotland, and both southern and northern England, has become much more salient and is more politically resonant in England than hitherto. Devolution has certainly brought this issue to the attention of a much wider set of audiences, even if it hasn't created this issue itself. The last few years, the Barnett formula, the mechanism which distributes levels of spending on many, though not all, public services within England relative to that which is allocated to other territories in the UK, has come to assume the same kind of most iconic status among some English publics that it holds amongst nationalists in Scotland and Wales, who tend to see this as the site of territorially rooted disadvantage. The most recent polling on these issues, undertaken for the Future of England survey in 2012, reports that 52% of English respondents indicated that Scotland gets more than its fair share of public spending. 49% think that the Scots should pay for services from taxes raised in Scotland, which will become relevant in a moment, and 55% strongly agreed that Scottish MPs should not vote on English laws, which I'll come to as well in a moment. For the English, the question of the territorial allocation of public funding provides a resonant example of what has gradually become a more widely and loudly made political claim, that the centre favours other national communities as well as other cultural and religious groups over the peoples of the heartland. And of course, that there are variants on that claim depending on because that claim is also made in relation to different groups within England as well as in relation to other communities. Such an argument, which has grown gradually, has become of increasing resonance in the last 10, 15 years, has not only helped prepare the ground for the populist nationalist politics associated with UKIP, but has imprinted upon emerging forms of Englishness a powerful residue of grievance. Disquiet over how spending is allocated in the UK is far from novel. And in other respects too, pressures contributing to the politicisation of territorial relations, which do not stem directly from devolution, have also grown considerably, but now interact with the territorial system that devolution introduced with powerful consequences. One vital and rather neglected factor of this kind arises from the system of election used for the Westminster Parliament, which produces a highly bifurcated regional pattern of results. Whereas the party system, certainly in the political science literature, was typically seen as one of the major bulwarks of the union, given the success with which unionist parties channeled different kinds of local, territorial and national complaint into the functional language at the heart of British politics, I think it could well be argued now that the party system is exacerbating, or aspects of it, the politicisation of territorial differences. Now, I've then got a reasonably long section, which I'll spare you, on essentially how the first-past-the-post electoral system significantly deepens territorial issues, or the politicisation of those issues, essentially by over-rewarding parties that are strong in some areas and under-rewarding them in others. So, to put it very bluntly, so that the Conservatives become predominantly the party of England at most elections, or most parts of southeastern England, and Labour's position in relation to Scotland and Wales, and then parts of its former heartlands, is reinforced. Just as an aside, had a proportional voting system been introduced, I think it is interesting to speculate on to what degree that would have mitigated some of the dynamics of the politicisation of these issues, because you would, of course, have had Conservative representation in Scotland, you would have had Labour being represented in more parts of England, and the impact that might have had upon the political culture, upon the policy thinking of those parties is, I think, a very interesting consideration. But I'm going to skip I have a longer disquisition on that, and I will leap over. A further contributing factor to this shifting national mood has been the continuing decline, and emphasise here to continuing, it's not novel, of those forms of Britishness that helped inculcate support for the Union at the popular level. This broad trend gathered momentum in the early and middle years of the 1990s in England, I argue here, and yet in comprehending of the possibility that the English might be starting to think of themselves in national terms rather than constitutional terms, as it were, continuing to identify British institutions and a political system, the Labour governments attempted in different ways to promote a civic idea of Britishness as a form of popular patriotism throughout its years in office. Not only did this enterprise fall flat, it may well have had the unintended result of deepening an identification with England, not Britain, in those parts of the country that were most opposed to Labour. Britishness continued to wane as a source of popular nationhood in this period, though it's certainly not disappeared entirely, and I think has transformed into a sort of more instrumental more instrumentally, which is not to say that it has disappeared. But its depletion has also removed an important obstacle to the development of political claims and arguments rooted in notions of national identity. Under the coalition, territorial politicisation has undoubtedly intensified further. That's partly because of what's happened in Scotland, and the key argument the SNP has, which is that the English vote Conservative and will continue to do so. But I think more importantly than that is the emergence of a deep-seated dilemma now in territorial terms for the Conservative Party, which for so long, of course, has been the primary guardian of the statecraft tradition. For the bulk of the 20th century, it identified integrally with the Unionist cause and remained opposed to most, though not all, schemes for reform of the Union. But now, at the start of the 21st, the party finds itself overwhelmingly English in terms of its parliamentary representation and increasingly English in terms of its support base. And it is, I would suggest, starting to handle the trade-off between its unionist vocation and its nationalist temptation rather differently. The party's leadership has undoubtedly supported the Better Together campaign, and, you know, Cameron has aligned very clearly with support for the Union. But what is interesting, I think, is to note is that that increasingly is more reflective of a political calculation than it is a kind of the pull of unionist tradition, though the latter has not entirely disappeared. But political considerations are also leading the party pretty inexorably towards the idea of engaging more fully with English sensibilities. And there's clear indications that once the referendum in Scotland is over, that the Conservatives are likely to make some sort of announcement about identifying with English votes for English law, some sort of reform of the House of Commons. Whether that's in the election manifesto or prior to it, I'm not sure, but it's pretty clearly an issue on which they're going to alight. Equally, and this is, I think, is really important and probably hasn't quite been fully grasped in the commentary it's received, the party had a commission on what would happen in Scotland, what offer it would make to Scotland if Scotland votes no in the referendum. This is the Strathclyde Commission. Some of you may have seen reports of it. And its devolutionist proposals significantly outbid Labour. So it signs up, it essentially agrees to hand over income tax
to Scotland and did several other taxes. And given where the Conservatives were at in terms of sort of prior thinking on Scotland, I mean, there is an evolution here, but this is a pretty significant step away from a certain kind of unionist statecraft, which also, of course, raises some very challenging questions about a future UK-wide economic model and whether actually that degree of devolution would hand some of the levers which the state, fiscal levers which the state may well still need to, well, still wish is to control. So there is a shift there towards a certain kind of proto-federalism on the Conservative side, which is certainly not settled and it's still intensely debated on the Conservative right, but it reflects a certain kind of political logic. Labour, meanwhile, has morphed into the role of constitutional Conservatives, defending the post-devolution settlement from all comers and remaining wary of arguments about or in terms of English national identity. And whilst it may well propose some fairly significant forms of decentralisation within England, as opposition parties increasingly tend to do, the party itself is still appears locked out of many of the regions and constituencies that lie outside its historic areas of strength. And its adoption of the One Nation mantra suggests a pretty willful blindness to the current nature of territorial politics in the UK. So we've got 5 minutes to go. Okay. I think put together, I don't think it's sort of desperately controversial to suggest that there is now an abiding uncertainty about the kind of traditions in constitutional terms upon which, or the standing upon which, the platform from which the parties are operating. The kind of generic problem here, how to reform the union, how to put it on a new footing so that it survives, is increasingly haunted by the fear that any of the kind of available mechanisms or schemes for reform may generate unpredictable kinds of territorial dynamics, which may themselves, in their own right, lead to further instability. This mood has led some commentators to speculate that the cumulative governing wisdom, which Bulpit and others highlight as a hallmark of statecraft in the UK, may have disappeared entirely. Now, that's a judgment that informs a number of recent arguments for the idea of the UK to become a federal polity. I was going to discuss those, but I won't here. I'm very happy to answer questions on them. Two of the really interesting expressions of that argument. One has come from David Marquand very recently in an essay in Prospect, which some of you may have seen, which essentially picks up on the kind of radical democratic argument made by people like Tom Nairn, Anthony Barnett for many years, and argues that the answer to all this is a written constitution, codification, and a kind of a movement that this will release popular energies from below and that this will refound the state. Another very different, somewhat overlapping, and really interesting argument has come from Gordon Brown. I don't know if anyone has seen his new book, which makes, it's a classically Brownian argument because of the fervour, the kind of commitment for what is ultimately a really oddly Whiggish account of how you shift from the current UK model to a radically different federal model. I mean, it's a very, very interesting statement and document. I won't sort of pour through this. I'll just conclude on what I think is missing about those arguments, what I think is missing from the wider debate in these areas. What is notable about pro-federal positions and a growing number of arguments for a more loosely constituted union is how little attention they pay both to the UK-wide dimension of the polity they envisage and to the capacities and strategic understanding of the centre. The underlying assumption is that a new governing code will arise from more transparently stated democratic principles and a more clearly articulated set of rights and responsibilities for citizens. Yet even in the more federal system imagined by Brown, a significant raft of powers are retained at the UK-wide level, and these would inevitably require levels of coordination and cooperation, as well as strategic decision-making. And they imply a pretty robust and highly strategically-minded centre, which could also employ plenty of soft power in its dealings with other tiers of government. But this centre would have to be detached from the different territorial administrations that would operate beneath it. Like many other progressively-minded constitutional commentators, Brown and Marquand hesitate over this key point. That is, how to delineate some form of English government of representation from that which prevails in the UK. But without addressing the question of how 85% of the polity's population are to be represented and governed in such a model, it is hard to see how federalism can be meaningfully implemented. At the same time, when it is addressed by federalists, some go for an English parliament, or some go for a slightly watered-down version, an English Grand Committee, it becomes apparent that the government of England comprises a good deal of the government of the UK and would be almost impossible to separate from the latter. Bullpit, by contrast, pulls us away from the peripheralist thinking that infuses federalist dreams and takes us back to the foundational question of what kinds of governing intelligence and outlooks are lodged in the higher echelons of the state. Above all, his work enjoins us to ask what kinds of strategic capacity there is to evolve a new coordinated approach to territorial management. As the parties grope their way towards competing models of a revised union, the question of state-level coordination, how the encompassing identity of the UK citizens is to be expressed, promoted, and perhaps now codified, and the need to insulate UK government from territorially rooted pressures, all need to become foundational, not incidental, issues. The question of whether older forms of statecraft have dwindled is important for two overriding reasons. First, because a polity, however differentiated, needs a unified sovereignty, which gives expression to foundational interests and encompassing identity. And since, in functional terms, a system that disperses power and responsibility more widely necessarily requires an effective and intelligent central agency, which can resolve conflicts, ensure coordination, and deliver the public goods, defence, foreign policy, etc., which ensure the polity's survival. The lack of attention to these questions indicates the triumph of constitutional law over considerations of government in current debate about constitutional policy. There are, to finish, I think, still reasons to believe that statecraft, or that there are elements of familiar patterns of statecraft that might still be recouped, might still be reconstituted and drawn upon. I don't think they are. That model is any longer sufficient. But there are aspects or resources which I think are widely overlooked in current debates. Very quickly, I think the residual adaptiveness and pragmatism associated with the centre's outlook and in the culture of some of the state institutions still feeds down into parts of Whitehall and into Westminster may well stand the UK in reasonable stead in years to come. Secondly, it does seem to me that actually not having a codified constitution could well actually be a significant advantage when it comes to dealing with the sort of nexus and combination of issues, pressures, which come both externally and domestically, which of course was one of Bullpit's great sort of foci, the idea that politicians are dealing with these pressures simultaneously. And then thirdly, because, and this sounds bizarre, I know, to say, given the current state of play, perhaps in Scotland, but the rationale for the UK is in some ways stronger now than it has been for many years, given problems of Europe, and yet at the same time a kind of underlying inexorable rationality for union, given the range of the combination of economic and security issues facing nations and states. And that era, it seems to me, that era of small-scale nationalism, which felt confidently that it could issue forth into the expression of state sovereignty, is in many ways actually we're living through its decline, which sounds odd given how well the SNP have been doing. But as I say, that I think is rooted in other kinds of political factors. My final point is this: is that the renewed focus upon the centre that I would propose can be separated from normative characterizations of centralism. There is currently, as you know, an increasing focus on the case for devolving powers and budgets to cities, regions, or whatever in England, and this too has major implications for the question of what kind of centre is now needed. There are those in both main parties who are deeply concerned about the implications of the state giving up some of the policy and funding levers available to it. But there is a good argument to suggest that a less burdened centre, which plays the role in some areas of regulator, auditor and referee in relation to other tiers of government, may well be more able
to recover some parts of its strategic capacity and understanding, which some of which are currently lost or blurred. The key question here, to repeat, is what kind of centre and governing outlook are required for a state that is run by actors who have lost faith in its centralising past, for the most part, and no longer seem to believe in the efficacy of policy solutions that are designed in and delivered from Whitehall. A centre-focused perspective need not be a centralist one, nor need it be conservative when it comes to the organisation of state or constitution. Thank you.